listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, low-powered, solar-powered, people-powered, listener-sponsored community radio. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and usually Caroline, but today my co-host is Shemaine Montana, and I was able to see Caroline, who's my mother. She was with me last evening to go to the Fairfield Concert Association duo guitar concert, which
nice.
Was, yeah, because she's a longtime guitarist and guitar teacher, so it was really, really fun for her.
Nice.
Yes. And how are you today, Shemaine?
I'm great.
Great. We have a really wonderful guest today that we're very excited to have here on Writer's Voices.
Absolutely. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Covey. Recognized as one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential Americans, Stephen Covey has dedicated his life to demonstrating how every person can truly control their destiny with profound yet straightforward guidance. As an internationally respected leadership authority, family expert, teacher, organizational consultant, and author, his advice has been given insight to millions. The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People has been named the number one most influential business book of the 20th century. It has sold nearly 20 million copies and, after 20 years, still holds a place on most bestseller lists. Vice Chairman and co-founder of Franklin Covey Company, Dr. Stephen Covey earned an MBA from Harvard and a doctorate from BYU, where he was a professor of organizational behavior. For more than 40 years, Stephen Covey has taught millions of people, including presidents of nations and corporations, the transforming power of the principles that govern individual and organizational effectiveness.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Dr. Covey.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be with you.
And next week, we're going to all get to welcome you to Fairfield. I understand. You'll be making a rare appearance here in Fairfield on Friday, November 20th at 9:30 a.m. in the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center.
We're looking forward to that.
Now, I have to ask, why Fairfield?
Well, that's where the Maharishi Award is being given.
Well, that is true.
And so...
Will this be your first visit to Fairfield?
Yes, it will be my first visit.
Great. We're looking forward to welcoming you.
Now, how did that connection get made? You know, how did you decide, how did they decide to give you this award, and how did you decide to accept it and come here? Is there a story behind that?
Well, it's in connection with a speaking tour I'm taking, starting Monday and ending on Friday.
Oh, so we're your grand finale.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I think that we'll make it worth your while here.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it because I've never been there.
How much? Do you know anything about Fairfield?
Very little.
Very little. Well, you'll learn a lot while you're here, I'm sure. But one thing that you should know is that we have a community of very spiritually aware people of many different faiths, and many of whom ascribe to the universal principles that you've been teaching for your entire life. So I think you'll feel like you're among friends when you get here.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Because those principles are universal and they're also timeless.
Mm-hmm. One theme running throughout your books is that you talk about principles as the timeless and universal basis for lasting effectiveness at the individual and collective level. And in your writing, you make a distinction between principles and values. Will you describe this distinction for us?
Well, values are kind of personal and subjective, and they govern people's behavior, but principles govern the consequences of that behavior. For instance, if I don't treat you with kindness and respect because, let's say, we're upset and I'm arguing with you or there's a big difference or something of this nature, I will live with the consequence of that kind of unkindness and disrespect. Mm. and the trust between us will go down. If, on the other hand, there's a difference between us, but I listen to you with true empathy, that is within your frame of reference, and restate your point to your satisfaction, what areas to the body to be understood is to the heart. Mm. And the two of us will be able to produce creative third alternative solution to our problem. It's not my way or your way, it's our way, and we're also emotionally committed to it.
Now this
is... I teach this kind of communication when I'm out there as well, and when people are not defensive toward each other, but very respectful, even though there are profound differences, the creative energy comes in, and people then become able to produce third alternative solutions.
As I was reviewing the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People last night, one of the habit number 5, which is really what you're talking about right now, really did strike me as very profound. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. And it's, you know, like you say, because being understood is to the heart, like air is to the body, many of us grasp for understanding without realizing that offering understanding is going to get us understood more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because the whole key to human influence is first to be influenced. I trained all of the Indian chiefs in North America, that's Mexico, the United States, and Canada, and after about 2 days of training, they gave to me a special gift called an Indian talking stick, and it was about 5 feet high, and they put my name on the backside. They called me Bald Eagle.
No pun intended.
Nation taught this to the founding fathers of our country. And I think it powerfully influenced what took place in the creation of our Constitution in Philadelphia.
Now, the talking stick is where whomever holds the stick gets to talk and everyone else listens.
And restates the other person's point to their satisfaction.
Ah.
Which means you have to listen within their frame of reference. Mm. You can't just listen and prepare your own response.
Mm-hmm.
This takes a lot of personal security. That security comes from personal integrity. That's why the first 3 habits are foundational to habit 5.
Now, Dr. Covey, when you wrote the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, did you consider yourself a highly effective person?
Well, I'm not a paragon of all I teach. Hey, I was talking with my kids, and my son said to me, I know you're trying to empathically listen to understand, but I have a sense that your mind is made up.
Ah. So they can see through it.
I like many of these habits, and whenever I do, and it comes to my awareness, either socially or internally through my conscience, I always apologize.
Mm. Well, that's the beauty of timeless principles, is that it's a lifetime process.
It is.
And they never grow old.
At our 51st grandchild.
No kidding.
Well, I'm having my first in a few days.
Well,
maybe today.
So exciting. I congratulate you.
It could be today. I don't know. Any day now.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Covey, our community is very interested in working with awareness, and I noticed in an interview you did with the Global Dharma Center in 2006, you talked about awareness, and you called it the space between stimulus and response. And you talked about how in that space you have choice, and if you follow good principles, that space of freedom gets bigger. Can you explain this a little bit more?
Well, it's the whole idea that we always have the power to choose our response to any given set of circumstances. And if you're deeply founded in universal and these timeless principles. Then I use the magnet as an illustration. Your natural tendency is to respond with in consistent with those principles, and the more you do that, the larger the space becomes between what happens to you and your response to it, and the greater your freedom becomes. And in today's world, we've moved from the industrial age to the knowledge worker age. When people have moved to that age, the necessity for them to have a large repertoire of responses and to have a large space between what happens to them and their response is absolutely imperative. Otherwise, they can't really operate efficiently inside their own particular job. This is also the key to getting a job. You always see yourself as a solution to a problem, not just another problem that people have to handle because you're focused upon interviewing techniques and resume making up.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you operate on these principles, the larger the space becomes until you have an unbelievable level of freedom inside.
Now, I don't know if this is quite the same thing, but in my experience in personal relationships, for example, in an argument or something, I don't like to respond right away, because when you do, sometimes you say things that you aren't going to mean the next day, and it's hard to take things back after they're said. And so I like to put a lot of space in arguments. And basic, which has its downside too, because sometimes that means shutting off communication. But
what you're doing is restating the other person's point to his or her satisfaction until that person acknowledges your point.
Mm.
And when that happens, it causes the other person to be less defensive and more relaxed and more open and more creative. And then when you could even say to them, I hesitate to give my response at this time because I don't know if I'll be consistent with it tomorrow. And you even can say that, and the other person would restate that point. The more the two of you understand each other from within the other person's point of view, the more the creative energy enables you to come up with third alternative solutions. I'm writing a book right now for attorneys, those who hire and train attorneys, those who don't want to hire attorneys, called Blessed Are the Peacemakers. Now we've found over 10 different firms in the country, because the big issue to attorneys is, can I make money doing this? Well, these 10 firms are outstandingly successful from a financial point of view, because they developed a reputation of producing third alternative solutions. My co-author to that book is a federal judge who uses Indian talking stick communication in chambers all the time.
Wow.
That's,
that's great.
Court. Another thing is, if you shift your paradigm in the field of crime to where policemen give more positive tickets than they do negative tickets.
Positive tickets.
And their partners, their business partners, redeem those tickets with entertainment packages or food packages or whatever. Little by little, the whole culture changes. And the norms and mores of the culture enable crime to go down 80 to 90%. And that's another book I'm doing right now called The End of Crime.
Well, one of the
I'm doing 10 books right now, and I have a research component on each of those books, a research team that is researching it to show the evidence, empirical evidence, not just anecdotal, of how it works.
Well, Dr. Covey, it seems like you're living out habit number 6, synergize, mm-hmm. with all these projects, because you're working with co-authors on most of them.
Yes, I am.
How does that process work? Have you always done that? Have you always had co-authors with your books, or is this something that you've come to lately?
To produce these 10 books with the research team, I usually need a co-author, and what I do in my writing is to walk around an audience and connect with their pain and their frame of reference. And I'm sent many, many books for endorsement purposes, and I can tell within 15 minutes whether the book will work or not.
Mm.
If it's in the lens of the writer, it won't work. If it's in the lens of the reader, it will work.
That's true.
By constantly being in touch and then recording what happens with their questions and their expressions of pain and challenge, it enables me to deal with that, and that's why all my books start with the pain of the reader.
Now, when you're working on a book project, do you initiate the concept and hire the team, or do people come to you with an idea and want you to get involved in it, or both? Does it work both ways?
It's kind of a synergistic process where it is produced like a third alternative through the interaction of the team that I'm working with that I have permanently, and then we hire research teams to go out and do it. For instance, the other day I was in Colorado visiting with the governor, and he said that his main goal was to reduce recidivism. And I said, you can get it down to less than 5%, so you don't have to build new prisons. And he said, how do you know that? I said, we've just been putting on the 7 Habits training program at your correctional facilities in Colorado. And we have a PhD research team that is analyzing what's happened to these people once they've been released from prison.
Mm.
There have been 900 have gone through the training program, 600 have been released, and not one has returned to crime.
Now,
you still have to do the research with those who have left the state and left the country, which we haven't yet done, and some of those may have returned to crime. But nevertheless, the recidivism is significantly reduced.
Now, one of the problems in our current economic environment is that as states are trying to save money, one of the first things they do is cut those programs. And I actually have a friend who's in a maximum security prison that I visit, and I know what's going on there. And so that's they cut the funding for those type of programs first, which in the long run doesn't make economic sense.
Right.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
I think you're right, and that's happening all over the country.
Yeah, and the thing is, we know that what you put your attention on grows, and so this idea of rewarding good behavior in at-risk communities rather than focusing just on the problem behavior, it seems like a really obvious thing.
It does, and also in moving to the knowledge worker economy rather than the industrial age economy, which was a top-down, boss-controlled, boss-centered culture. In moving to that, you get rid of bureaucracy, and you don't have rules and regulations that take the place of human judgment and human creativity, and you can significantly reduce your costs.
Is that idea related to one thing you said in your latest book, that the economic breakdown is about a breakdown in moral authority?
Absolutely.
Can you explain
Gandhi
that?
Gandhi was the founder of India and never held a formal position. I just had a great personal visit with Nelson Mandela. He got his moral authority in prison over a 26-year period. We gave our Principal Center Leadership Award to Colin Powell, who said one of the most electrifying, several years ago, one of the most electrifying experiences of his whole life was to go to Nelson Mandela's inauguration. Mm-hmm. He comes from the back as if from the people. There on the front row on his left side are his loved ones. On the front row on his right side are his jailers called warders. If you read his book, The Long Road to Freedom, his autobiographical account of his experience in Robben Island Prison, You'll know that they tortured him and treated him terribly. He bows to these men and says, "Good morning, gentlemen. It's wonderful to have you here." So he makes reconciliation and he forgives. I just took a tour through Western Canada with the Dalai Lama, and his capacity of compassion and forgiveness is so deep and so real and so powerful, and it comes from his rich private life and from his deep convictions to Buddhism.
Now,
I can teach the same thing in from the Quran, from Hinduism, from Christianity, from Judaism, from all six major world religions. We're in 60 different countries now, my company is, and we're teaching these timeless and universal principles.
Now, your company is Franklin Covey?
Yes, Franklin Covey.
And you are, let's see, you're the co-founder and vice chairman. Is that still your title?
Yes, that's right.
And how did that company come to be founded?
Administrator is more as a teacher and a writer.
How did Franklin Covey come to be founded? When at what point in your career did you co-found this company?
10 years ago, it was a merger between our work called Covey Leadership Center on the subject of leadership and Franklin Quest. People who developed a focus on time management.
Okay, that's where I'd heard that before.
Right.
Yes, yeah. And why did you decide to join with them?
Are you still with us?
I am.
Okay. So, Dr. Covey, why did you decide to join with Franklin?
Well, it seemed like a very synergistic relationship because they were in all kinds of businesses with their time management focus on getting clear sense of priorities and so forth. And we were into the leadership field, and the first three habits of the seven habits is all based upon coming up with a very clear vision and purpose and strategic goals and then living by it. And values, and then living by them so that you have enough internal emotional security that you can practice win-win, seek first to understand, then to be understood, and synergy. So it seemed very synergistic to us, and it has proven to be so. This very difficult economy, we are exploding.
Congratulations.
And you consult... Franklin Covey consults with many, many Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies, correct?
So over 90% of the Fortune 100 and over 70% of the Fortune 1000.
Now, when you first published when you wrote Seven Habits for the highly effective people, you were a professor at that time, correct?
Right.
What was that your first published book?
No, I published other books in the field of religion before. One is called Spiritual Roots of Human Relations. Another one is called The Divine Center, which is based on putting Christ at the center of our lives. And then I also wrote one on marriage and family with a friend of mine, Truman Madsen.
What made you turn your attention to business?
Well, I felt that there are principles that are universal and timeless, and that if I could help business cultures get focused on those principles, that it would reestablish trust with all stakeholders and also would enable us to move from the industrial to the knowledge worker economy. I just finished giving 5 lectures at the Peter Drucker Centennial down in Los Angeles. He's the one that coined the term knowledge worker.
Right.
It's a great term because it expresses basically that you move away from disempowerment and micromanagement into decentralization and a heavy level of empowerment and helping people find their voice, which is the overlapping of their talent, their passion, their conscience, and the marriage with the need of the organization. So when a person is looking for a job, they need to really research in depth that company and also their customers, their suppliers, and their other business partners to understand their pain. Then when they go in to get a job, they try to show a marriage between their background, passion, and talent with those pains and challenges, and it just about guarantees them to get a job. I give this advice to 10 people, only one will take it, because most people are still based on the paradigm of developing interviewing skills and trying to develop a very impressive resume, you know. But the key is to be a solution to a problem. Otherwise, you're just a problem to the HR department to have to deal with you.
Well, as an employer, I can understand that, you know, if someone came to me with, well, it depends. It depends on how they approached it. If they came into me and I felt like they were telling me how to run my business, I probably wouldn't hire them.
Yeah.
So there has to be some certain degree of humility. But if I could tell that they had researched and really understood the business and understood
the
job.
Kind of research they've done on your organization. First of all, that'll blow most employers away.
Right.
That you have done this kind of research on their organization.
Absolutely.
To understand what their challenges are. And you're not coming in to tell them what to do. You're coming in to try to create a marriage between your passion and your talent and their challenges. Most people do not know how to hire this way. They hire based on interviewing and resumes.
That's
and
true.
And then they don't end up with a complementary team where strengths are made productive and weaknesses are made irrelevant to the strengths of other people.
Hiring is one of the toughest things to do in business. I actually am involved as a co-founder or officer in 7 different companies. So I have numbers of employees from, you know, 1 to hundreds. And so I know hiring is one of the hardest things.
I think one of the key questions to ask is, from your earliest memory, what did you love doing that you did well?
Oh, that's a great question.
Really, you'll see a pattern. If you come up with a particular talent or capacity or skill that you really need, then you can develop a complementary team where strengths are made productive and weaknesses are made irrelevant to the strengths of other people.
Now, when you were working on writing the 7 Habits, how did you identify and distill the principles that you saw in business down into these 7 really
powerful habits? It came more from empirical research. And it took about 20 years to produce that book.
Wow. Wow.
Dr. Covey, you've said that the purpose of a business organization is to serve human needs, which is what you were talking about just now. And I've noticed that businesses grow and they kind of morph and start to focus on serving their own survival. Would you agree with that? And what can businesses do to avoid that shift in focus?
They do. They shift their focus away from adding value to the customer. The whole key is to understand the customer from within the customer's frame of reference.
You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUULP 100.1 FM, and our guest today is Dr. Stephen Covey, the author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People and his most recent book, Predictable Results in Unpredictable Times. Dr. Covey will be visiting Fairfield on Friday, November 20th, speaking at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center at 9:30 a.m. That's free and open to the public. And I have a feeling it's going to be standing room only, so you might want to get there early.
Dr. Covey, you talk about primary success and secondary success. Will you describe that for us?
Well, I think that secondary success is basically trying to get a reputation and kind of a perception in people's minds having to do with your capacity and talents and so forth, where primary success deals with your character and the level of your integrity and your moral authority. Because in the long run, formal authority without moral authority produces the top-down, boss-centric culture that is part of the industrial age, which is becoming obsoleted. I mean, just look what Toyota is doing to Detroit.
Exactly. Now, the interesting thing is, because you talk about knowledge workers, and we tend to think of that as people in an office and people, engineers or educated people, but we still need production workers, we need farmers, we need people who are working with their hands, but they also can, you know, can be bottom up and use the same principles as you're talking about. It's not limited to just knowledge work and people working on computers, is it?
Absolutely not. I think that you've grasped the idea that a knowledge worker is any person who has contact with the product and with the customers. I had a tremendous interview the other day with the head of JCPenney, and he said, we find that we can improve our revenue like 30% through three things. One, how you greet the people. Two, how you express your gratitude for them after you finish visiting with them. And three, how you solve their problems. And if the salesperson is a knowledge worker and has a huge repertoire of responses, and can solve the problems, including saying, we can't solve your problem, which preserves that person's integrity, and the trust toward that organization goes up, simply because they have acknowledged that they don't have the capacity to solve another organization's problem. And little by little, what happens is that you get tremendous customer loyalty through this approach. And Frederick Reithold from the Harvard Business School put a lot of emphasis upon what he calls the net promoting score. And what you want are nines and tens. And those people are very loyal to you. They will be repeat customers, and they'll continue to buy from you. They'll trust what you say because you're not putting on a lot of hype. And you're authentic and real and honest.
You know, integrity in business seems like a very simple principle, but in practice, it's something you have to think about every day. You're faced with decisions every day that sometimes it may seem like the easy way or the most profitable way isn't in line with your underlying integrity, and you have to keep that in alignment all the time. It's not a simple thing.
I appreciate in this book, Predictable Results in Unpredictable Times, that there are charts and lists of questions to ask yourself and to give your business a little scorecard to keep in touch with this.
Dr. Covey, let's talk a little bit about this book, which was just published, I believe, in August.
On the culture.
Yeah. What?
I'll introduce that system when I present next Friday morning. It's called XQ, and you can get it freely off the internet. It's www.theeighthhabit.com, and it'll tell you about XQ. And you see, financial accounting comes from the industrial age and calls people an expense and things like the phone we're using right now
an asset.
I mean, just think of that.
Yep.
Instead of realizing that people are your highest leveraging asset. That's why it's so important to win a private victory every morning, where you get alone and you deeply think about your entire day and you commit to live by principles that day so that you have total integrity.
So, Dr. Covey, with this book was written specifically for the economic times that we're in.
Right.
But the principles apply to all times. So even when the economy rebounds, that won't make this anything in this book obsolete in the least.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Will you give us a little sneak preview?
60% to become part of the top 20%. The key is to involve everyone deeply in the problem so that the whole culture changes and buys deeply into the purpose and the strategic goals, and that everyone knows how their role has a line of sight with a particular strategic goal.
Will you give us a little sneak preview of the four main points of this book that you're
also... We have a film on how in most organizations they're like little kids running around, and they don't have a clear understanding of what the purpose is.
Dr. Mm-hmm. Covey, why don't you give us a little reading from the book right now?
Okay, what pages did you want me to read from?
Well, I really liked the story on page 31, the beginning of chapter 2, Move with the Speed of Trust, where you're talking about the heart surgeon or the infant, you know, the children's surgery team. I think that's a really fascinating story.
I just did a program over in Finland with Lance Armstrong. Seven good habits and seven victories.
That must have been fascinating.
Yeah, in the mountains, trust makes all the difference, meaning in the toughest times. Great Ormond Street Hospital in London has earned a reputation 150 years in the making, at the forefront of children's services in all aspects of care, especially critical surgeries. But at one point, some years ago, seven infants died in quick succession following heart surgery. The surgical teams involved were devastated. Clearly, something was wrong somewhere. Not only was the crisis causing the public to lose confidence in them, they were also losing confidence in themselves. A great deal of researching and soul-searching went into the investigation of these failures. Soon they learned that the most dangerous time in the surgical procedure wasn't in the operation or in the intensive care unit, but in the journey between the two. According to Dr. Martin Elliott, you have to discover that disconnect the baby from a lot of kit, put it on a trolley, move it down a corridor, reconnect it to another bunch of kit, and transfer a lot of knowledge about the baby from one tired team to a new fresh team. After one discouraging day, the surgical team collapsed exhausted in the physician's lounge. A Formula One auto race was on television when the surgeons noticed something remarkable on the screen. They became fascinated, not by the race itself, but what was going on in the pit. When champion driver Michael Schumacher roared into the pit, the team that serviced the Ferrari racer went to work as if they were one person. Dr. Alan Goldman recalls, a bunch of guys got themselves very organized, came in, changed the tires, filled up with fuel, exchanged a lot of information, and they set off again in 6.8 seconds. The doctors leaned forward and stared at the screen, amazed at the speed, efficiency, and absolute precision of the pit crew. And that, says Dr. Goldman, seemed to us to be remarkably similar to the process that we were going through. In the world of Formula One racing, the difference between winning and losing is measured in tenths, even hundredths of a second. And although winning-driven usually gets the glory, winning drivers usually get the glory. It's really a team effort that makes the microscopic difference. The driver must stop periodically in the pit lane where a team of 20 or so trained people jack up the car, replace all four tires, fuel the tank, and make instant repairs. Obviously, they must do this as fast as possible. For every 10 seconds a car is in the pit stop, competing cars will gain about half a kilometer. The Ferrari team is one of the best in the world, and it was their high-speed precision that caught the attention of the doctors in London. I got in touch with them, Dr. Goldman says, and then we went to Italy and showed them videos of our processes. The Ferrari people were stunned at how chaotic it was. No one in charge, lots of conversation, lots of people in each other's way, unclear systems. One mechanic recalls, when we first saw the footage of the surgical team, I can remember thinking, wow, they sure are disorganized. We saw where people were standing, what they were doing when they were just waiting. So it was no surprise to see them shuffle when the unexpected happened. Doctors, people like me, said Dr. Elliott, are trained to help. So if you imagine that when the patient came back from the operating room to the ICU, it was a new challenge for everybody. We would all rush around the bed, getting in each other's way, all talking and trying to help. This is fundamentally opposed to the way in which the Formula One pit crew works. They know their job. Each one does it. Silently they do it, and they get out of the way. They trust each other. The surgery team learned quickly and soon introduced a system that defines carefully who does what and in what order. Every action is focused and productive. Everyone has to make a contribution. Now we know exactly where everything's going to be at any given time, while before it was very random, says an operating room nurse. Errors dropped by half. Patients thrived. Seeing them get better and seeing the results improve dramatically is just magic, Dr. Elliott says with perfection. Next Friday morning, I'm going to show a film that illustrates what I just read.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. So, Dr. Covey, this is a very timely book, and I'm wondering that as a writer, how do you get a book written, edited, and published quickly enough to speak to current events?
The key is the research team and then teaching it. When I teach it and I record what I teach, then we go over the editing. We have editors, professional editors, that really shape up the language and make it more readable.
So in a sense, you're writing for the spoken, for speaking, and then your team helps convert that into writing for the page.
Right.
Right. And because there's a big difference in writing a speech and writing something, an essay, you know, how the flow of the language.
There is. You don't just sit down at your desk and start writing. That comes out of your head. But if you're dealing with the kind of pain that this surgical team experienced, where they lost 6 children in a row, you can imagine how humble and open they were to an entirely new approach used by this Ferrari team in the Formula One racing.
And who would have thought that the mechanics would have anything to teach the doctors?
Exactly. They're all knowledge workers. They trust each other. The key is the culture of high trust with all stakeholders. But you can only merit high trust through absolute trustworthiness.
Mm.
Transparency.
At all levels.
Pull in the problem and then work out the solution together.
Dr. Covey, who are some of your favorite authors and influences in the field of business and personal success?
Finished representing, and that is Peter Drucker.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And, but I do a lot of work, I do a lot of reading in philosophical and religious literature. And, I'm very fascinated by the meditative sciences, particularly TM.
Hmm. Well, then you're coming to the right place next week.
I think I am.
Now, your book, the Habits, the 7 Habits book, was rated as the most influential business book of the 20th century. How do you see the results of that influence? What do you perceive, you know, do you see changes in our society and business culture that you can point to and say, maybe I had something to do with that?
Well, notice how important trust has become in our society.
Mm.
When trust is high, costs go down and speed goes up. And you save a tremendous amount of money. When you have decentralized and empowered people, opened up the way for people to find their voice, what they're really good at that they love doing, you have unleashed a tremendous talent. It's kind of like a choral group. The tenors don't take the place of the sopranos. They work as a team.
I happen to notice that just this year the FDA started a transparency task force. And so this idea of transparency and repairing broken trust is definitely permeated in the culture.
And apologizing when you make mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. In fact,
making reconciliation, and
sometimes you need to apologize even if you didn't make a mistake.
Yeah, apologizing for the difficulty, apologizing for a misunderstanding.
Yeah. I have a saying that I like to use in that I'd rather be rich than right. So if somebody, you know, meaning which if somebody wants me to admit that I'm wrong about something, I don't take it personally.
I'm working on another book called The Real Identity Theft, The Cultural DNA. In other words, we're immersed in comparison-based approaches where a person's sense of their own worth goes to the social mirror. When man found the mirror, he began to lose his soul.
Mm.
The point is, he became more concerned with his image than with his self. And last night I was studying Shakespeare, and I memorized one of his sonnets. Do you want? It's not too long. Do you mind if
sure.
I?
Oh, please do.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone. Let's see. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone moaned my lonely state and troubled death, heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and cursed my fate, wishing me to one more rich in hope, with this man's art or that man's scope, with what I'm most contented, with what I most love contented least. Then my heart, like the lark at daybreak arising, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, I scorn to change my state with kings.
Ah, that's beautiful.
In other words, the spiritual DNA is eclipsed by a cultural DNA of comparison-based cultures.
But there's no comparison.
Self moves outside to other people's opinions rather than coming from your own deep sense of integrity.
That's actually very profound, because it is so easy to get caught up in...
Theft means someone's found your wallet and uses your credit card. That's a very superficial definition of identity theft.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Covey, you said it took 20 years to write the Seven Habits book. Was it an immediate success when it was published?
No, it took a great deal of word of mouth. In fact, our publisher didn't even like the name. He thought it was too long.
Why did you choose to use the habits of effective people rather than successful people? Was that a deliberate decision?
Yes, it was. We wanted to define effectiveness, which means getting results.
Mm.
The way we define results is not just financially, but culturally and mentally and spiritually.
So successful maybe had too much of a monetary connotation?
Yeah, I thought so.
And you wanted a broader connotation.
Put that name out there at the Frankfurt International Book Fair, and it came out on top, so we used that one.
Okay, and so... You published it, and then you had to go to work.
The eighth habit deals with organizational and leadership.
Mm. Were you surprised at the eventual success of that book?
I was.
And how did it change your life?
Well, it got me involved in traveling the world and building a very successful business, and... I've been able to train now 34 heads of state and their cabinets and their legislatures. And I had a tremendous personal visit just before President Bush left. I just wrote a book called The Leader in Me, which we're going to present to President Obama and Secretary of Education Duncan.
Mm.
I was with Obama on a tour while he was running for president, and he said, if I win this contest, will you come and help me? I said, absolutely.
So it doesn't sound like you've had any problem living up to that, to the success of that book. That you've risen to the occasion.
And doing more.
I liked, I can't remember the exact words, but somewhere I read that your sort of your personal motto is to live life as a crescendo. Mm-hmm. Was that correct?
Life in crescendo.
In crescendo. Tell us what you mean by that.
That means the most important work you'll ever do is always ahead of you, never behind you. So forget the past, just keep contributing to make a difference in dealing with the kinds of issues and problems. In fact, the opening, I'm doing a book on that one right now, and the opening page shows a couple leaving a golf course and going to a kind of a cocktail party. And on the that's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, you see their kids, one's in jail, one's on drugs, one is unemployed and looking for a job. I mean, their family is in shambles. No other success can compensate for failure in the home.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing you don't believe in retirement.
Not at all. I think that's an absolute apostate notion. But you don't ever retire from extremely meaningful projects.
Well, what I'm looking forward to as I get older is I feel like the older I get, the less I will care about what other people think. I mean, I'm hoping that that's true, and that will empower me to do things that I might be afraid to do now.
I think that's a very good point, and I think you'll be driven more by your conscience.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely...
That's the inner sense of what you know is right for you to do.
Right. And the thing is...
Model that for your children and grandchildren.
You learn. You actually learn your conscience as you... I mean, you're born with a conscience, but you develop it even more as you grow.
Absolutely. As your consciousness deepens and increases, your conscience does as well.
Exactly.
Receive personal guidance from your conscience, and that becomes the source of your security, your integrity toward your conscience. So the key is to educate and obey your conscience.
Right, and that educating your conscience is important because the more principles of natural law you learn, the more you can work with those principles and the more freedom you have.
Exactly. That becomes the content of your conscience, those universal and timeless principles, and then also your awareness of the pain and the needs out there.
Now, Dr. Covey, we only have a couple minutes left, and we like to encourage writers among our listeners, which many of our listeners are writers. What do you have any particular words of advice for an aspiring writer, someone who has an idea for a book, who has a book, is trying to get published?
Always start with the pain and the needs of the community you're trying to reach.
Mm-hmm.
Don't start with your own theoretical formulations.
Wow.
Well, I'm just real curious, Dr. Covey, how those beautiful mountains of Provo looks today.
Oh, they are magnificent.
I lived in Provo for a time, and they are...
Mountains, and I have a four-wheeler, and I take off almost every day and go up those mountains.
Wow.
In the magnificent nature.
Great. And I wanted to ask, too, in 2008, you launched an online community. What kinds of things will people find at your online community, and what's the URL for that?
It deals with a lot of the new projects that I'm involved in and also the findings of our research teams. And we have about 100,000 that belong to it now. It just started, and so we're getting very excited about it. I also do a lot of telepresence communications where I can see the audience and see the person asking the question, and also they can see me, and so we interact a lot. And I do a lot of using this new technology.
Well, Dr. Covey, thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices, and we look forward to seeing you next Friday, November 20th, here in Fairfield at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center.
Well, I look forward to seeing both of you, and I hope you'll both come up and give me a hug and a kiss.
Absolutely. So thanks so much, and see you next week. And if you're listening to Writers' Voices on Friday, stay...
A wonderful interview.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it so much. If you're listening to us on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Earthwild. James Moore is going to be interviewing the director of Zeitgeist. And I think he's got some other interesting guests. He usually does. Pretty amazing things. And I think, I think David Lynch is in the studio right now recording an interview also.
It's a big day.
It's a big day at KRUU. And if you're listening to Monday morning to our rebroadcast, please stay tuned for the Best of Broadway. And I forgot to get a quote from Mom today, so I'm going to use one from Predictable Results in Unpredictable Times by Stephen Covey. And by the way, I want to thank Tony at 21st Century for getting us this book at the very last minute. He did a great job finding it for us, and he's got plenty of books, this one and Covey's books, other books there available for sale as well. You are exposed to the improbable only if you let it control you. You always control what you do. By Nassim Nicholas Talch. That's from Predictable Results in Unpredictable Times. And see you next week on Writers' Voices, where we'll be interviewing Hope Edelman and the possibility of everything.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.